All right. Well, thanks, Lars. Okay, so let's see. First thing I sent out, I spaced out, I sent out the last minute. I actually changed my title. Don't worry, it's the same talk. It's ARMO. I just gave it a more general title. So this is actually a good talk to be giving here because this is the latest chapter in this long and exciting saga with all its ups and downs. And the main bit of the saga that I'm going to be talking about, that the latest complicated chapter, actually started here when Lee Lindblom and I were visiting. I guess it was for the workshop on neutron stars. So that would have been August of 2000, something like that. Yeah. So basically, there's been a lot of excitement on this obscure set of oscillation modes called R modes for the last few years for various reasons, and I'll just go through briefly the resume of why people are excited about this incredibly obscure thing. The basic idea is that there is these modes are unstable, at least in perfect fluids. There's this gravitational radiation instability where the back reaction of emission of gravitational waves drives these things rather than damps them like you'd normally think. And people have known about things like this for, well, since the 1970s, so I guess about 30 years now, in perfect fluids. But the thing that got really exciting was it looks like this instability could survive not just in these balls of perfect fluid, which you don't really see a lot out in the universe, but real neutron stars, or at least some version of real neutron stars with real complicated, messy physics, which includes viscosity. Basically, there's a couple of astrophysically interesting scenarios. The first one, the one that I was initially all fired up about, and I'm less fired up about these days, is that you could explain, potentially generically, why the spin frequencies of young neutron stars are what they are. So the question's always been, why is the crab spinning a factor of 10 slower than the fastest known pulsar? And you'd think when these things form, collapsing down in a supernova explosion, that conservation of angular momentum would make them spin up as fast as they possibly could, so that they're at the Kepler limit, where stuff at the equator is flying off. But you've got observations of pulsars up to 600 and, well, 600 and something hertz. But that thing is an old, cold, recycled pulsar. It's not one of these young ones. So, for various reasons, some of which I'll go into in this talk, I'm not as hot about this scenario as I used to be. But the other scenario people were interested in, and it was actually Lars who first pointed this out. I wasn't too hot on it at first, but over the years it's starting to look better and better. And this is, yeah. So the basic idea is here is you look at older neutron stars that are rapidly accreting matter from a more or less normal companion. If you're accreting rapidly enough, like at the Eddington limit, you're burning a lot of material very hot. You get up a couple hundred million degrees. You make X-rays. You see these things in X-rays. They're the famous low mass X-ray binaries. It's been a puzzle for a while why the spin frequencies of these things are what they are. They're not an order of magnitude slower than the fastest known pulsar, but they are something like a factor of two slower. And again, this is a bit of a puzzle because if these things are not just accreting mass from their companions, they're also accreting angular momentum, presumably. And you'd expect they'd all be these things accreting at Eddington limit for a long time would be spinning up as fast as they possibly could. It's also a bit of a puzzle as to why the spin frequencies are clustered more or less in this fairly tight range around, say, 200 to 400 hertz. It's only a factor of two variation, but when you look at the accretion rate, you would expect it would track the accretion rate, which varies by orders of magnitude, and it doesn't. It's just varying by a factor of two. So both of these scenarios, the young neutron stars and the older rapidly accreting neutron stars, while this instability is going on, however it's happening, you can emit gravitational waves, and not just sort of academic silly amounts like people had seen before. You could actually emit potentially interesting amounts of gravitational waves. And when you crunch through the numbers, these things might be detectable by LIGO. Not LIGO today. Well, LIGO's down today. It's having some upgrades, but the initial design sensitivity, well, actually might remotely stand a snowball's chance in hell of seeing something, but that's not going to be on until the end of the year. But after a couple of years of upgrades and the more advanced interferometer technologies people are working on right now, LIGO could actually see a pretty decent event rate for some of these sources, potentially. So there's a nice prospect here of getting some observational feedback. First question people usually ask is, what's an R-mode anyway? It's not a household word, even in these circles. Pictures worth a thousand household words, so here's a picture. What we've got here is a view seen from an inertial reference frame. So the idea is we're sitting out here not rotating, the star is rotating, and what we've done is we've dropped a bunch of buoys down on the surface of the star. So we drop these buoys on a grid in latitude and longitude, and they move around for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's the overall rotation of the star, and to keep track of that, we've painted one line of buoys red. That's this line. It was dropped along a line of constant longitude. That's going around the star, and you can see how the star is rotating. And in addition, we put these chains between buoys on, that were dropped at constant latitude. And there's this R-mode perturbation on top of the uniform rotation of the star, and that perturbation is pinching these rings. So there's this pattern of disturbance that's going around the star. The key physics in the R-modes is rotation. In some sense, that's really what the R is for. There's a whole zoo of neutron star modes. They're complicated objects. You hit them with a hammer and they ring in all sorts of ways. There's P modes, restoring forces pressure. There's G modes, where it's gravity. And there's S modes and T modes, shear and torsion modes in the crusts. And probably a couple others I've forgotten. But these, the restoring force is the Coriolis force. So that's what sets the frequencies. And that's also what gives the modes their R-modes their unusual shape. An R-mode is something that, unlike the other modes people look at, it perturbs the velocity of the fluid elements, but it hardly touches the density. There's a very little perturbation of the density. And again, that's because of the Coriolis force. Coriolis force, it goes like delta V cross R, so to a good approximation, it's just pushing stuff around on spherical shells. It's not pushing things up or down and compressing them very much. And what you see here, this sort of motion on the outermost spherical shell is the same on spherical shells all the way down inside the star, but with a smaller amplitude. Now, by smaller amplitude, I don't mean going down exponentially as you get below the surface. These are not evanescent surface waves. They go down as a power law. So you genuinely are getting R-modes all the way down into the core, where densities are very high and funny states of matter can live and all sorts of interesting physics is going on. So if you observe these things, there is some direct coupling to regions of a neutron star that are, well, the densest matter in the universe that you can't really access by other means. So now that you've had a chance to watch this thing going around for a while, you can see, hopefully, that the pattern, which you can track by looking at the pinched loop, this pattern is rotating around counterclockwise, so it's going with the star, but not as quickly. And it's easier to see that if you go and look at the R-mode in a co-rotating reference frame. So now here we're hovering over some point on the neutron star. So here's this line of red buoys that's going around at constant longitude. And as we hover over this point, what we see is that these fluid elements are sort of circling around their unperturbed rotations. Now that we've subtracted out, or unperturbed locations, now that we've subtracted out the rotation. Actually, they're ellipses, not circles. There's a latitude dependence. And it's really clear now that we're hovering over this point on the neutron star, we see that the pattern is moving around backwards. It's moving around clockwise, so it looks like it's going backwards. If you remember, it was actually going forwards, just not keeping up. And that's important because gravitational radiation, well, all radiation, is going to live in an inertial frame of reference. It's going to think this mode is going around forwards, so the radiation reaction is going to try and fight it. It's going to push the mode back. Now, the fluid is living in this reference frame. As far as the fluid is concerned, this mode's already backwards, so as it gets pushed further backwards, it's going to get driven rather than damped. And that's really the essence of the instability that was discovered by Chandrasekhar and elucidated by Friedman and Schütz in the 1970s. You'll see this thing referred to in the literature sometimes as the CFS instability. It's just the initials of these guys. Well, that's the pictures. In a little more quantitative detail, here are some more fun facts about R-modes and why they're different from the other modes. So basically, they're unstable. I should have said in perfect fluids, they're unstable for any mode quantum number and rotation frequency of the star. And that's very different from the other modes, like the fundamental pressure modes, acoustic modes of stars. You have to rotate really fast so that the frequencies get dragged around into this prograde retrograde confusion. Or you need to have really high mode quantum numbers, which means when you put in viscosity, which you need in the real world, there's lots of damping and these things get killed. R-modes are nice because they're unstable all the way down to zero frequency, and any, well, you can only go down to a mode quantum number of two, but any quantum number higher than two. their mode frequencies, like I said, are given by the they're essentially some constant times the rotation frequency of the star. This is the rotation frequency of the star, and little omega is the frequency of the mode. That's just the Coriolis force. And then there are these corrections at order omega squared. There's corrections to everything at order omega squared, and that's because when you have a rotating star, it's no longer spherical. So the Coriolis force isn't purely shoveling things around on equipotentials anymore. It's going to couple a little bit to the order omega squared equatorial bulge and the density and equation of state stuff. So the velocity perturbation mathematically, it looks like this. I said it's a power law in R as you go down, so it genuinely does extend substantially down in the star. The angular dependence is this R cross grad YMM, which is known as a magnetic parity vector spherical harmonic. That's just important because there's no divergence of these things, and the divergence is what gives you velocity perturbation is what gives you the density perturbation. So the density the velocity perturbation looks like this plus order omega squared corrections. So that tells you that the density perturbation is zero plus order omega squared corrections. And in some well-defined sense, omega squared is always a small number. So the density perturbation, it really is small. Actually, the kind of strange thing here is that Papaloisiu and Pringle were the guys who actually coined the term R-mode in a paper in 1978, and then the Friedman and Schütz paper came out really putting this instability on a firm theoretical footing and showing that it was not just some fluke in Chandra's algebra. So they wrote a companion paper trying to evaluate all the modes that were known at the time and see if they were unstable, and they dismissed the R modes out of hand because they have this weird structure. There's hardly any density perturbation. They're all velocity or current perturbation, and so they coupled the gravitational radiation through the standard formula you see in textbooks, where you're taking time derivatives of the mass quadrupole moment, but rather through these current multipoles, predominantly the current quadrupole moment. And this is just some aspect of what's called gravitomagnetism. It's basically the idea that if you expand the Einstein equations in powers of V over C, like if you look at the equation of motion for a test particle, you'll get something that looks like the Lorentz equation, the Lorentz force law in electrodynamics. So the part of the force is this electric part, it's the gradient of a scalar potential, that's the Newtonian gravity we all know and love. And the next order term in V over C looks like V over C cross this sort of magnetic looking force. And that comes from mass currents in the same way that the real magnetic field comes from electrical currents. The math's all the same, it's just with different constants. So the funny thing about these, which I was actually the first one to figure out, is that the R modes are a lot stronger than people thought because you can couple efficiently to the velocity perturbations through these terms that are normally left off as higher order corrections. So just to go back and talk about a little more of the mechanics of the instability, usually at this point people start putting up something about the Friedman and Schütz formalism, and in some sense you really should, because they did develop a really nice way of dealing with perturbation theory of rotating fluids, which is a very hard topic for all sorts of technical reasons I won't go into. But because it is very technical, and given our location, I thought it would be really nice to talk through a cartoon version of a broader class of instabilities, put this in some context. There's this whole class of things called two-stream instabilities. The CFS instability is one of them. There's Kelvin-Helmholtz and Rayleigh jeans and, well, all sorts of others. And if you live in Southern California for very long, which I did at the time, you start asking yourself maybe at some point, why do you get decent surf out here? Well, not so much in Santa Barbara itself, but in Southern California in general, why do you get decent surf out here when for 8 or 9 months out of the year, there's no weather? There's no rain, there's hardly any wind, what's going on? And well, if you look on the surfing websites, it turns out they'll say things like, oh, it's going to be a great day because there was a huge thunderstorm off New Zealand 19 days ago. So these waves got whipped up and crossed 10,000 miles of open ocean somehow for almost 3 weeks. How'd they survive? How'd they get there in the first place? Well, sort of the answer is something like this. So suppose you're standing in the water and there's air above the water. And so you slap the water and you make this wave go off in this direction. And there's some sort of complicated interaction between the air and the water through this wave. And actually, it's there are different effects dominating in different regimes, and it really is complicated. There's a dissipation version, and there's a non-dissipation version, and there's a reason meteorology is its own science, but at some level, regardless of the details, your physical intuition probably tells you whatever that coupling is doing, it's sort of acting like friction. It's going to fight, if the wave is sent off this way, the coupling is going to fight it and try and push back on it. It's going to leach energy out, the amplitude of the wave is going to die down as it propagates, and eventually you're just going to get still, flat water again. Fine, that's the way dissipation should act. But things change when you've got relative motion. The example here is wind. So now you've got the air and the water, and you've got this wind blowing. The wind's blowing off in this direction, so you do this again. You go whack, send out this wave off, but it's not propagating fast enough to keep up with the wind. Well, what happens in that case is someone riding along in the wind thinks that wave is propagating backwards, and so this coupling, this sort of friction-like force, is going to drag it forwards. It's going to have to pump energy into the wave. The amplitude's going to grow and grow until something interesting and nonlinear happens. And that, well, I just told all sorts of lies here, but under some fairly restrictive range of parameters, this is one of the dominant mechanisms for whipping up waves. Anyway, I think it gets the point across better than the standard canonical energy calculations and stuff like that. If not in detail, at least in spirit, this is the right reason why this works. And you get the same sort of pattern everywhere in nature with the formation of spiral arms in galaxies, superradiance in black holes, all kinds of things. It's exactly the same as this picture. It's just that, you know, you take this flat stretch of water, you wrap it around, so you're looking down on the north pole of the neutron star, you replace translational symmetry by rotational symmetry. It's the same thing. You've got some confusion between two frames of reference about which way a disturbance is propagating. And you got to have the coupling between the two frames of reference, which is gravitational radiation. All right, so there's this instability in perfect fluids then, and that's all been worked out a while back, but to see what happens in the real world, you need to see how fast things act. So you need to be evaluating driving and damping timescales under semi-realistic conditions. So the way you do that is the standard thing. Well, you say, okay, nonlinear hydro is hard, so we take some mode, it's a perturbation on, say, a uniformly rotating background, and the standard thing in perturbation theory, we've really got a time dependence e to the minus I omega t with a little complex part on the frequency, so there's a e to the t over tau dependence. There's this exponential growth time scale, or equivalently, you can express it as a growth rate, which is 1 over the time scale, and you compute that essentially from the finding that, you know, if your delta V and your delta rho, you can compute the energy in the perturbation, and you can relate it to the total energy being pumped in by gravitational radiation minus the sum over all the viscous mechanisms present of the amount of energy being leached out by each type of viscosity. Functionally speaking, there are two kinds of viscosity you're worried about in fluids. The main one, the standard one that people deal with, is shear viscosity, and to compute the energy loss, it goes something like this. You're doing a volume integral of some coefficient eta. This is just a coefficient of shear viscosity you work out from some detailed microphysics. You can do that, and you're just integrating that times the shear tensor squared, or the perturbation in the shear tensor squared. This is just the symmetric trace-free part of the gradient of the velocity perturbation. This is just the normal viscosity, like tar glooping out of a drum, where fluid elements are moving past each other at different rates. You've also got to worry about bulk viscosity. This is the resistance. This is how much energy you're leaching out when you're compressing and rarefying a fluid element. If you did that infinitely slowly, nothing would happen, because you'd be in chemical equilibrium all the time. Or nuclear equilibrium, I should say, when we talk about neutron stars, because it's nuclear reactions that are the internal degrees of freedom. But as you're compressing and rarefying not infinitely slowly, then the reactions don't quite have time to keep up, and so you're generating a little heat, a little entropy each time, and you're leaching energy out. And when you work out how that goes, you're basically doing a volume integral of another coefficient, a coefficient of bulk viscosity, zeta, times the density perturbation squared. And that was actually the tricky bit to get. Gravitational radiation driving, then, you calculate the dEdtGr. It's a big complicated mess, so I copped out and just said, okay, it's a sum of some mass multiples squared, some time derivatives of mass multiples squared, plus, more importantly for the R modes than for other stuff, the current multiple time derivative squared. Well, it depends on the temperature. So the density, so the RMODs have a small density perturbation compared to other stuff. So the coupling to bulk viscosity is a lot weaker. But it turns out there is a mechanism of bulk viscosity, which is the main thing I'll be talking about towards the end here, which got neglected for a long time. It turns out to be really huge and compensate for a lot of the reduction that you get in the RMODs. All right. So you want some kind of you need to look into the microphysics of neutron stars then, and that's a complicated, messy subject. But you want some sort of baseline calculation. You say, well, with some pretty conservative model of the matter, what's the minimum amount of physics you can put in that's pretty well tied to stuff you can measure in the lab, and then build on that. So your baseline timescale calculation. You need a baseline neutron star model, and that's just an NPE fluid, just an ordinary fluid with neutrons, protons, and electrons. Standard sort of thing. People have started working out some of this. Well, I guess these guys had a series of papers in the 1970s working out from neutron scattering cross sections that you can measure in the lab. You can work out doing a bunch of collision integrals what the shear viscosity coefficient should be. And when you plug in all the scalings, the way it works out is that the shear viscosity damping rate goes as 1 over the temperature squared. So shear viscosity is more effective at killing the modes at low temperatures, and it's bulk viscosity at high temperatures, or this particular bulk viscosity. So the main sort of bulk viscosity people looked at for a while, the baseline bulk viscosity, is just coming from beta decay and inverse beta decay. These are the reactions that made the neutron star full of neutrons in the first place. And as you go back and forth, you make neutrinos or antineutrinos, depending which way you're going. You've got a conserved lepton number. And the neutrinos and antineutrinos basically leave. So this is not only responsible for bulk viscosity, but it's also responsible for the cooling of the neutron star, at least at reasonably high temperatures, 10 to the 9 degrees or so. And this stuff, well, for various weird historical reasons, this is known as the IRCA process. I'm still not entirely sure why, and no one will give me a straight answer. But Ray Sawyer, actually, who unfortunately isn't here, did the classic paper on this in the 1980s, and people have been pepping it up a little since then. But the basic answer is then that the bulk viscosity damping rate, 1 over the time scale, has a little bit of frequency dependence in it, but it really takes off with temperature. So the damping is really effective at high temperature. And that's basically because you're involving a bunch of degenerate fermions. These neutrons and protons and electrons, they're all degenerate. So you've got all these factors. Well, it's even worse than that. You've got spectator baryons on either side. So you pick up a lot of factors when you're doing your phase space of KT over the Fermi energy.
Just on curiosity, why is there a
frequency dependence in bulk viscosity? Well, basically, it comes in that density perturbation. So there's a, the DEdT actually has a mega to the fourth in it, and then when you divide by the energy, it comes out to a mega squared in the end. So you go through this, and then you calculate the scalings for the gravitational radiation driving time scale, and you get the inverse time scale. The driving rate scales very strongly with frequency. It's independent of temperature, of course. You don't care about temperature, it's basically zero. But it goes as the frequency of the star to the sixth power. Now, so these are all the scalings, and if you plug in numbers at some fiducial value of frequency and temperature, so let's say the maximum possible frequency of the star, the Kepler limit where stuff is flying off at the equator, and you plug in, say, 10 to the 9 kelvins for the temperature, then you find that these timescales are respectively years for shear viscosity, millennia for bulk viscosity, and minutes for gravitational radiation. So that's interesting. And potentially, then there's some region of parameter space where this mode will grow really fast. So what you want to do is plot this instability curve. And this is our baseline instability curve. The first one we started off with, well, okay, so first let me explain what it is. We've got our axes. We're basically interested where do neutron stars live in frequency and temperature plane. The frequencies can go down to basically zero, and then they can go up to some value, which is at least 700 hertz or so. neutron star models were doing here, it's typically more like 800 hertz or so, I think. And depending on the equation state, it could go up a bit more. But basically, this is the whole range of frequencies you can have. If you go much faster than that, things fly apart. It's the Kepler limit. The temperatures we're looking at, actually, originally we were looking all the way up to 10 to the 11 degrees. That's the temperature you get coming out of the supernova. So if you're interested in this R-mode spin-down scenario for newborn neutron stars, you'd want to look all the way up to 10 to the 11, and this green line would climb up very steeply as you go to 10 to the 11. And then as you go down in temperature, the standard scenario is neutrino Urca cooling gets you to 10 to the 9 degrees within a year of the supernova, and then you keep cooling by other mechanisms more slowly. But we're going to be looking at not at these very cold isolated things, but we're looking at low mass X-ray binaries. They're getting a lot of matter dumped on them, so they're kept pretty hot, like 10 to the 8 degrees. So we're plotting from 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 10 degrees here. This green curve then is the actual instability curve. The instability curve is the set of points where the power pumped into the mode by gravitational radiation exactly balances the power leached out by all the viscous mechanisms. And with this baseline model, there's just these two viscous mechanisms. So on this line, the star is borderline unstable. Above this line, as the spin frequency goes up, gravitational radiation gets a lot stronger very quickly. So radiation driving winds above this line, at least one R-mode is unstable. And conversely, below the line, gravitational radiation rapidly loses its effectiveness, and the instability gets damped by the viscosity. So basically, you want to look where's. Yeah.
On this curve, is there alignment to the crossover point between your bulk viscosity and your viscosity?
Yeah, so because of the temperature range I'm interested in this talk, you can hardly see it. Basically, it's picking up a little bit here, and if you go all the way to 10 to the 11, it jumps off, or jumps up a cliff like that. That's bulk viscosity kicking in. So I guess the minimum is around here. Few times 10 to the 9, was that 4, maybe 5 times 10 to the 9? That's bulk viscosity is dominating the dissipation above that, and shear viscosity is dominating below that. So by comparison, all the other instability curves people have looked at for the F modes and other things, they were just lousy. I mean, you only had a little dip right here. So there was some incredibly tiny region of parameter space where the instability could operate. Here, at least in the baseline version, the initial version, it looks pretty optimistic. After all, most of this graph is above the instability curve. So there's some, good area here. But we knew things couldn't be quite right even in the very beginning, because, well, partly because we knew the minimum, even at high temperatures, had to be a bit higher because of this new Young pulsar. But more relevant to this talk, there's these low mass X-ray binaries, which are spinning, I don't know, you see them, they're a couple times 10 to the 8 degrees maybe, and they're spinning maybe 200 or 300 hertz, so they're around in here. You can't have these things sitting there above the instability curve, at least not for very long. So we knew from the beginning the curve had to go up, and that's fine because as you, on theoretical grounds, you already know as you get temperatures below 10 to the 9 degrees or so, you get more and more complicated physics coming in, and each new bit of physics, you can make the dissipation, you can make the viscous damping go up, but never down, or almost never down. Turns out even superfluidity, which you do get below 10 to the 9 degrees in the neutrons and protons, actually makes the viscosity stronger rather than weaker, which is just one of the many weird things about this problem. All right, so anyway, that's the initial optimistic baseline instability curve. The next, for this temperature range, the next most important piece of physics we're going to put in that's actually going to determine the instability curve around a few times 10 to the 8 is probably what goes on when you've got viscosity in a boundary layer under a solid crust. So to recap then, here's a slice out of a neutron star, just a neutron star that's older than a few minutes. So basically, you need to cool down to a temperature of 10 to the 10 degrees or so. Once you start getting significantly below 10 to the 10 degrees, in the outer layers of a star, density is below about 1.5 times 10 to the 14 grams per cubic centimeter, which is about half the density of an atomic nucleus. You can get a solid crust. This representative slice of a star, well, it varies a bit depending which model of the microphysics you use, but the total radius of the star is something on the order of 10 or 12 kilometers. Out of that 10 or 12 kilometers, the outer 1 or 2 kilometers are going to be this solid crust. And I put the word solid in quote marks here because it's really more like jello than like rock. And if you condense all of solid state physics into one number, the ratio of the shear modulus to the pressure, it is basically jello. So below the solid crust, you've got this NPE fluid, and then way down in the core, depending on the equation of state, you might not get any, or you might get half the rays of the star being taken up by various funny particles, more exotic than neutrons, protons, and electrons. And the really important bit is this very tiny, say, 1 centimeter thick boundary layer just underneath the solid crust. It's the classic situation in fluid dynamics where you've got a fluid next to a solid. The fluid velocity has to go to zero over this incredibly thin boundary layer. It's essentially set by the coefficient of shear viscosity of the fluid. The boundary layer, it was actually Lars and Greg Ushomirsky who first pointed this out. The boundary layer being so thin winds up reducing the time scale for shear viscosity damping by a factor of roughly the ratio of the radius of the star to the thickness of the boundary layer, which is something like 10 to the 6. And then you get, if you really want to model this properly, you've got to take into account the fact, though, that this stuff is basically jello. It's not going to be nailed down in place while the R-mode is driving this fluid back and forth. Rather, the crust is going to move along largely with the fluid, and that's going to bring the relative velocities down and by some factor, and that's going to bring the dissipation down by some factor. And that was Lars's student, Greg Ushomirsky, again, with Yuri Levin. So you go, this is a neat problem, which I'll just skip over all the neat aspects of and say, okay, you put in the most careful calculation of the instability curve with a crust, and it goes up pretty dramatically. Doesn't go all the way up, so it kills off the instability entirely, but with some reasonable set of parameters that you put in for your modeling, you get an instability curve that goes about through the right frequencies. So now you can have things that are 300 hertz or so sitting at a couple times 10 to the 8 degrees and not be hanging out way out above the instability curve. Let's see, the salient features here. Well, never mind the kink. It's not that big of a drop anyway, and it's sort of complicated why it's there. The salient feature is that the salient features are that the curve has gone up in this temperature range, and it's gone up to the right frequency range, and it's dropping as the temperature increases. And that's again because shear viscosity gets less effective as temperature increases. It's actually a different scaling from what I said before because of this dependence on the thickness of the boundary layer, but it's the same idea. All right, so it was Yuri Levin who pointed out a very interesting aspect of this, which had me really down on the prospects for seeing gravitational waves from these things, and that is that you get this thermal runaway effect. So if you plot, so again, here's the same instability curve. It's actually such a generic argument. You'll notice the date on this paper is earlier, and that's because it's such a generic argument. He didn't even need to know that it was the crust. You just need to know that the curve is going down with temperature. So in this scenario, what you get is, let's say you've got a neutron star living over here. It's getting dumped on by its companion. It's heated up a little over 10 to the 8 degrees. It's accreting mass. It's also accreting angular momentum. So it's spinning up, spinning up, spinning up. Eventually, it hits this instability curve. When it hits the instability curve, once it gets out a little over the curve, the R-mode's unstable, it starts growing, and it's doing all that dissipation in the boundary layer, and that dissipation is going to heat the neutron star up. Neutron star is a degenerate object. It's cold, although it's 10 to the 8 degrees, that's cold, compared to the Fermi temperature, which is like 10 to the 12 or 10 to the 13 degrees in the inner layers of the star. So the heat capacity is lousy, and the star starts heating up, and it heats up more and more, and it's a lot faster than the accretion time scale, so you basically wander off horizontally in this graph. And as you get far enough, the key point is that the instability curve is dropping underneath the neutron star as it goes out here, and once the star gets far enough above the instability curve, you see it start emitting, the R-mode could get big enough that it could emit a significant amount of gravitational radiation. Then it starts spinning down. Again, there's a mismatch in time scale, so it basically drops vertically or almost vertically, and it hits the instability curve again out here. Once you've hit the instability curve going this way, you shut off the R-mode. The R-mode starts decaying. You've shut off the heat source, so it starts it stops spinning down and it starts cooling down and it comes back where it started. And this is actually a limit cycle. So if you start anywhere on this plane, you'll get sucked into this curve, this loop. Now, this is a scenario that's still more or less compatible with the observations of low mass X-ray binaries, because you see the spin frequencies, depending on the slope of the curve and how far you get, the spin frequencies are going to have this distribution between roughly 200 and 400 hertz, and that more or less matches what you see. But it's lousy if you're trying to detect gravitational waves, because when you talk about the time scales that it spends going around this loop, the red lines, the time that the star is above the instability curve, and therefore the time that it's actually emitting gravitational radiation, that duration is something like a few months. But the amount of time that the star spends cooling down and then spinning up underneath the instability curve, so it's not emitting, that turns out to be millions or tens of millions of years. So the duty cycle on this thing is just lousy. And even if you consider all the low mass X-ray binaries in the galaxy, and that's where LIGO can detect these things, in the galaxy, there's no way it's going to see anything outside. There's just not enough, and you just don't expect to see anything. That changed after Lee and I, well, that changed about 4 years ago, when Lee and I were visiting here. We started getting indications, we were working on a different problem, but we started getting indications that hyperons, for example, in the core of the neutron star could be really important. Okay, so this is another thing that's not exactly a household word. So what are hyperons, right? I don't think they even call these things hyperons anymore. It's a really outdated term. If you want to be really spiffy, you say these are the bottom octet in SU3 cross SU3 cross SU3. Or if you want to be slightly less spiffy, you say these things are neutrons and protons on steroids. They've got a strange quark in them. So the main ones that you're interested in are the lambda and the sigma minus, so that you've got an up-down strange or a down-down strange combination. You know, they're just the next version of our familiar nucleons. Because of the strange quark, they're going to be a little bit heavier. Neutrons and protons are 900 MeV. These things are, this one's 1100, this one's 1200, and then there's more hyperons out there, but they get heavier. They're like 14, 1500 MeV, and because they're heavier, they're harder to make in neutron stars, well, and in the lab. So depending on the details of the microphysics, you say, okay, these, as the Fermi energies of the neutrons get higher and higher, you've got a couple hundred MeV to spare to make up for that increased rest mass. So you should start getting hyperons at densities above about twice nuclear density. So 5 or 6 × 10^14 grams per cubic centimeter. And you start forming these things through a couple of channels. Well, you start getting this whole maze of reactions that's possible. Just an example, you've got two classes. You've got leptonic and non-leptonic channels. The leptonic ones are basically like beta decay or related things all over again, depending whether it's a neutral or a charged hyperon. And these reactions, once again, are responsible for cooling as well as bulk viscosity. And that's because the neutrinos basically leave and take their energy with them. More importantly, it turns out, there are non-leptonic channels for forming these things. And so you can get the matter in equilibrium, or nearly in equilibrium, with reactions like this, where you've got a spectator proton or a spectator neutron, and you just send neutrons back and forth to lambdas. The non-leptonic ones turn out to be the most important ones for bulk viscosity, at least under most conditions. All right, so anyway, this stuff depends on low energy QCD, the details of the equation of state, which are all very uncertain. You ask 10 theorists what they think goes on in a neutron star, you'll get 20 or 30 different answers. But there are robust reasons to believe in these things, or something similar, regardless of all the poorly understood details. Robust reasons why you don't want to see nucleons in the core are just, it's expensive. As the density of neutrons goes up and up, it's pretty easy to get a couple hundred MeV per baryon to spare. And there are reasons, well, let's say you've got 1,200, I'll just list two of them here. Suppose you've got 1,200 MeV to make a baryon. That's your budget. What are you going to spend it on? You can make a neutron, which is 900 MeV, and it's going to have 300 MeV of kinetic energy. So it's bouncing around like mad. It's borderline relativistic. As it's bouncing around, it makes a lot of pressure. Or you can spend your 1200 MeV making a sigma hyperon that's just going to sit there because there's nothing left over of kinetic energy. There's no pressure on that thing, so the star can collapse down a little bit more and save on gravitational potential energy. And then there are all sorts of other reasons, predominantly isospin symmetry. You can easily get 150 MeV per baryon just from that. That's the fact that, you know, neutrons and protons sort of act like different aspects of the same particle, you know, spin up and spin down, so they call it isospin, with an utter lack of creativity. And as you get too many neutrons, you really don't want to have that kind of a state. There are lots of predictions that people make for exotic particles that can live in the cores of neutron stars. So people talk about pion condensates you'll see in the literature. That's less popular nowadays because there's some data that indicate those aren't favored as much as people thought. People talk about kaon condensates. They talk about just plain strange quarks floating around, or quark soup, basically up-down strange soup. People talk about, let's see, one of the latest things is Frank Wilczek's pushing this color-flavor locking, color superconductivity model, where there's this sort of weird crystalline state that in asymptotic QCD. But hyperons are nice because if you want to make, if there's a danger that you're going to be confronted with an observation sometime in the next few years, and you don't want to just make up numbers at random and play with things because they're cool, hyperons are nice because you can actually make them, well, you can make them in the lab in isolation, and even better, you can make them in nuclei in the lab. People do these experiments where they hit, I think it's mainly lithium and beryllium, and they can make one, or even better, they can make two of the neutrons turn into lambdas, and then they can watch them interact with each other and measure decay rates. So you've got, well, a measly couple of numbers, but at least it's better than no numbers. There's actually some good grounding for these things. And when you crank through the numbers, it does look like you get these at a reasonable density. Some of the other stuff is at such high densities, I have a hard time believing you'd see it, although you could get interesting effects. Hyperons are also nice because it turns out some of the other possibilities basically behave the same way. Like if you just get strange quarks running around, you'll get the same sorts of reactions. Numbers will be a little bit different, but a lot of this calculation carries through. Anyway, Peter Jones pointed out 30 years ago that this non-leptonic hyperonic sort of thing would create lots of bulk viscosity. Everybody promptly forgot it for 30 years, and then when Lee and I were visiting here, he sent us this little note reminding us, and then it went out to the world. So we started looking at this more carefully. So then you go in and do the careful or semi-careful calculation of revisiting all this microphysics and getting the new instability curve. With hyperons in the core, then, basically the instability curve below about 10 to the 9 degrees is unchanged. Here's this old crust curve. But you see a big difference above 10 to the 9 degrees. Essentially, you've shut off the instability completely. The star would have to be spinning so fast it would fly apart, and it's not interesting, between 10 to the 9 and almost 10 to the 10 degrees. So I should say that Lee and I actually didn't even look at this part of the curve. We were looking over at 10 to the 10 to 10 to the 11 degrees. We were interested in the young neutron star scenario. And it actually dips and then comes back up again. So there's this little window of instability, but you shoot through it so fast because of the enhanced cooling that it looks really bad for young neutron stars. And we left it at that. But Bob Wagner very shortly pointed out...
Sorry, what are the gaps then?
The gaps?
Superfluid.
Oh, the superfluid gaps. The lambda one is sort of loosely based on these measurements of double lambda hypernuclei, and the superfluid transition temperature peaks at around 5 times 10 to the 9 degrees, so few MeV. And then for this one, we took the sigma hyperon gap to be the same, although that could be greater by a factor of several. Okay, so let's see, where was I? Oh yeah, so yeah, Bob Wagner comes along and he says, there's a very interesting aspect of this that we didn't look at because we didn't look at 10 to the 9 degrees. And that's that you don't get a thermal runaway, you can get a thermal sit there, or a thermal sit there and radiate, which is really nice. So it's the same scenario where you get a neutron star spun up and then it hits the instability curve and it goes across, and if you had the instability curve continue to drop away underneath it, it would start spinning down and you get that limit cycle. But if you get the instability curve shooting up again in this cliff, it can just go right across and smack, stick to the side of the cliff. Or stick there with little wobbles. You can, you know, it's the classic overshoot and oscillate scenario. But basically, you know, it's a pretty robust result that you can sit there in two-way equilibrium. So there's spin frequency. You're in equilibrium with respect to frequency because you're trying to spin up from accretion, and yet you're balancing that by spinning down from gravitational wave emission. And you can do that with a pretty small R-mode amplitude. And at the same time, you're in thermal equilibrium, because if you try and push a little too hard this way, you get stabilized and lose your heat source, the R-modes. And if you go too far this way, then the curve drops out from under you and you get heated back up and pushed back. So you can just sit there and emit gravitational waves for a very long time. So instead of a lousy duty cycle of 3 months every 3 million years or whatever it is, you're talking about pretty much 100% duty cycle. And with all the low mass X-ray binaries in the galaxy, that's good news for LIGO, once LIGO has a few of the kinks worked out.
The temperature, you don't know what it is from observation. I mean, you can say there's some low mass X-ray binaries living over here, so that means equation.
You mean, can you observe this thing being at 10 to the 9 degrees versus 10 to the 8 degrees?
Yeah. Or you just know the spin frequency, that's it. The other is what you don't know.
Well, let's see. So the...
Then you can put something there, and there's lots of it.
Yeah, so I guess Lars would be a better position to answer than that.
Yeah, I mean, if they're sitting at 10 to the 9, then the problem is, if accretion were shut off, then you can actually see the thermal emission of the neutron star. If they're at 10 to the 9, thermal emission is extremely bright compared to what we observe. Mm-hmm. So for some systems where the accretion shut off and you've actually gotten to see the thermal emission coming out of the neutron star, the core temperatures are 10 to the 8, not 10 to the 9.
Yeah.
Now, there's other systems where we've not had a chance to make the measurement, so we don't know the answer. But where we've been able to make the measurement, it's always 10 to the 8.
Yeah.
But there's some systems that don't shut off and you don't get to make the measurement. That was pointed out by Ed Brown and Gray. Actually, there was a nice paper.
Yeah.
So then when you shut off the accretion, it should just sit there?
No, but I mean, you get short transient shut offs. We're just, I shut off and the accretion just goes quiet and you can see the star.
Oh, I see.
Just a brief for, 2 months or something.
Okay.
Yeah. But the
cloud's clear.
Yeah, the cloud's clear, but I guess it would depend how fast it cooled down. Because if it cools down to 10 to the 8, I mean, you're hot enough that you can get neutrinos still. So did Ed and Greg look at that?
What I'm saying is, if the Aquila X1 had a temperature of 10 to 9, it would be two orders of magnitude brighter than we see it.
In the quiescent state,
So you can rule out
but
the Aquila X1 is sitting in 10 to the 9 Kelvin. That's all I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You can rule out that it's.
Well, where we know the temperature's not that high.
Right. But when the cloud's clear.
Well, I don't know. Do you want them all to be able to sit there for a really long time, or just some fraction?
Well, if you want to see gravitational waves, you want to have as many as possible sitting here on this cliff. Now, the cliff could move around a bit.
But they can't all be there. You just said that something.
Yeah. Well, I guess it depends how long it takes when the clouds clear. How long does it take to cool down? Yeah.
Way too bright. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. When you see them in quiescence, they're 10 to 30
degrees. You almost wouldn't care about the accretion anyway. It's pretty close.
But everything depends on this curve, right? It's the curve in Wagner's paper is a little bit flatter, and so you didn't have to be sitting at 10 to 9. You could be sitting at something much cooler.
So yeah, Wagner's curve,
it's much flatter. Right?
It's not the barrels.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you can be sitting for anywhere.
Okay.
It must cool.
Okay. Well, is there a correlation between the accretion rate and stability of the disk? So, like in quiescent systems, you have to be below a certain systems that go to quiescence have to be below a certain accretion rate that you may not be able to heat them up to that. I don't know what the.
So the things that are really going full blast accreting Eddington, like SCOX-1, they can just be stuck there.
Well, if you just do something reasonable, modified ERCA. And it would be like 3 by 10 to the 8.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. But I'm saying the question is, what do we know versus what we think we can calculate?
Yeah.
So there are observations that tell us that some neutron stars are not that hot.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
That's all. The Aquila X1, Sen X4, was the long list.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean it's wrong.
But, okay, so anyway, I'd best move on here. So, Okay, so there were a couple things. You pointed out that Wagner's curve was flatter than the one I just showed, and that's because he sort of took our results and screwed them up. And then some other people tried to plug that in with this paper by these other guys, and they sort of took the worst parts of our paper and the worst parts of the other guy's paper and stuck them together, and the complicated, nasty calculations. So this is a nice idea. Bob's idea is nice, that we can just sit there and emit gravitational radiation continuously, at least for some of these systems, the ones that are accreting a lot. But how do we firm this up? So these are the guys who wrote the other paper. We scooped them by a couple of days, and it turns out, we did some things better. Although they did a better treatment of superfluidity, we were kind of a little sloppy about superfluidity because we were worried about the high temperature end. And you remember the band gaps, the transition temperatures were like 5 times 10 to the 9 degrees, so we weren't really worried about that. So they did superfluidity better. We did a bunch of other stuff better. There's some other reactions you can look at. These Dutch guys have been looking at lately. You really want to firm this up by not just picking one equation of state or one prediction of microphysics, but you want to explore the range of parameters that's consistent with the numbers that you get out of the lab. Because all of these things that you try and extrapolate have pretty big error bars on them. Speaking of errors, the literature is full of them, partly because this is a pretty hard kind of calculation to do, and partly because I don't think anybody thought it would really matter or really be testable very soon. Because all this stuff at such high densities and all this weird physics going on, in normal astronomy, you don't see the cores directly. But gravitational waves, assuming we can actually see them in the next few years, will couple directly to the interior, and we will get information on this high density stuff. So it's worth going back and doing it more carefully. There is a threat of observation soon, in other words. And we could learn a lot from them, for example, by looking at frequencies. I could, well, maybe I should talk about that later. So we go in and we do this a little more carefully. The particular stuff we were doing and we're going back and doing more carefully now, we're using an equation of state based on relativistic mean field theory, which is essentially a bunch of coupled Dirac equations, and then some equations for mesons mediating the interactions. Basically, that's because you don't use the Schrödinger equation, you use the Dirac equation because you need causality. The particles have Fermi momenta of hundreds of MeV, so they're pretty relativistic, especially when you consider that the mass of the quasi particle is really like 400 or 500 MeV. That some of them are really relativistic, and you can easily, if you use the Schrödinger equation, you can easily get speed of sound greater than the speed of light, which totally screws things up. So there are these different approaches to modeling the equation of state. Like there's the people who actually know something about nuclear physics, in contrast to us, generally want to model every bump on the potential in the Schrödinger equation, which is fine. I mean, that's what you have to do for their main line of business, which is predicting energy levels of laboratory nuclei. But for bulk matter, there's really only a few numbers you can talk about, and the details will kind of wash out, because whatever the interaction is, we can do a simple phenomenological model where we say, okay, in the mini particle system, it's basically going to divide into a scalar part and a vector part and an isovector. And we can put in some basic Lagrangian with some minimal sort of coupling, fit the coupling constants to the precious few numbers we've got in the laboratory, and deal with the uncertainties on these things. You have to actually be able to build your own equation of state, because you can't get the information you need by reading papers. Typically, they just give you some pressure versus energy density table. That's the standard thing people do, is just slap that in. But you need all these complicated thermodynamic derivatives to get anywhere with this. So you go and do that, and it turns out there's a derivation of bulk viscosity in Landau and Lifshitz, which we actually had to change around a little bit. There were two things wrong with it. One's not a bug, it's a feature. They were mainly worried about dissipation of sound waves in air. So you don't care about relativity, the fact in the atmosphere. The fact that the equations aren't relativistic is no big deal. But it turned out kind of surprising, there was actually a hole in the derivation. They were just quoting results from someone else's paper. There was actually a hole in the derivation, which we found when we had to go and redo it, because it turns out we have this network of reactions related by constraints. Typically, people treat either a single reaction or a bunch of independent reactions. Because for the sound waves in air, the bulk viscosity in air is transferred between rotational and vibrational degrees of freedom in the molecules, and that's not constrained by anything other than conservation of energy. But here you've got everything that goes on has to conserve baryon number, and so even though there's all this stuff happening, there's really only one independent reaction rate, Well, okay. Anyway, it's getting late and I'm rambling. So, all right. So you go in and you work out. You get this sort of formula for the coefficient of bulk viscosity. The relativistic version is a pressure, and then there's this factor, which is these two adiabatic indices. So you want to work out gamma zero is the adiabatic index for slow perturbations. That's just the equation of state. You know, when you infinitely slowly squeeze, what happens? And then the adiabatic index for infinitely fast perturbations. So you're really whacking this thing fast, and the nuclear reactions don't have time to go. So with that prefactor out in front, the remaining dependence involves this microscopic reaction time scale tau, and then the frequency of the mode. And the microscopic reaction time scales you get with this complicated calculation. That, you know, it's kind of fun. It's pretty gory, but it's kind of fun. You calculate some Feynman diagrams, get your matrix elements, do all these collision integrals, and use Fermi liquid theory to come out with the overall reaction rates, and then boom, this time scale comes out. And it varies from like 10 to the minus 8 seconds to, you know, like 1 second. So it goes, I should say another thing people usually do is they either take the limit of omega tau being small, so they drop this term, or they take the limit of omega tau being large, so they drop this. And here you cover the whole range of parameters. Omega is like 10 to the 4, so as tau goes from 10 to the minus 8 seconds to 1 second, you cover everything. And there is this regime then where you're matching omega and tau, where superfluidity actually dramatically increases the bulk viscosity. And that's responsible for that big rise and then sharp fall in the instability curve. So if you're mildly superfluid, there's a lot of viscosity. And then as you get cold enough, that everything is drastically superfluid, goes away. All right, so redo this. So this is something I've been working on with Mohit Nair, my grad student at Penn State. And I was hoping to get this wrapped up and submitted before I came here, but of course, the usual story of classes and whatnot, and then going in at the last minute and then realizing, oh, wait a minute, that factor of pi shouldn't be there. Oh, here's another silly bug, that kind of thing. We're still cleaning out all this stuff, so this is preliminary results, but they're qualitatively things have more or less settled down in the last week or so. We get a range of instability curves. We usually get a pretty steep cliff, and it goes from 10 to the 9 to several times 10 to the 9 degrees. For some scenarios, we can get it going more shallowly. And for some scenarios, we can actually get a bit of a shelf, that, you know, so the cliff doesn't go all the way up. There's a bit of a shelf, and then it goes down again. And that allows you to have young, hot neutron stars that are really fast being unstable, at least for a little while, as well as the older neutron stars. So the playing around with all the parameters, well, there's the legitimate exploration of parameter space, which is, you know, you do different runs for different parameters. And then there's the stupid way that we actually did it, which was we fixed all these mistakes and found that most of them didn't matter very much. As you might expect, the main thing that you care about as for the location of the cliff is the superfluid transition temperature of the hyperons. There's some other things that affect the steepness of the cliff, but it's basically the band gaps, and so the transition temperatures. And unfortunately, that's the part that's really hard to get. You get persistent emission of gravitational waves pretty much only on the low end of the predicted range of superfluid transition temperatures. And that's basically because if you move the cliff off to high enough temperatures, then the limit cycle takes over again. And then you also get eventually observational problems as well. And like I said, this is pretty recent, but it looks like for some parameter values, you don't get the cliff so much as you get a shelf, and it doesn't go all the way up, and you can get young neutron stars being unstable, at least for some small range of parameters as well. The neutron and proton superfluidity? Well, most of this stuff is going on at a temperature where the neutrons and protons aren't superfluid yet. Okay. So a little bit does near the end. That's one of the things we need to finish ironing out. We sort of put it on the back burner because you're usually above that temperature. But anyway, just the short roundup is it looks like the instability is still viable over some fairly decent range of parameter space, but it's not the answer is not yes by an order of magnitude or no by an order of magnitude. It's on the border region, which means it's interesting to keep doing a more careful calculation. And in principle, if this holds up, that it's on the border region, then you might imagine in your wildest dreams one of these days saying, oh, we saw R modes from this thing. That means that it couldn't have had hyperons in it, or that means the band gap had to be less than so-and-so. I think we're a long way from having things nailed down that well, but it's, you know, motivation for doing some more work. There's a couple things we could do better. One thing is everybody's really oversimplified the thermal effects, which are important for figuring out where you go in the limit cycle. And also, you know, trying to reconcile with the fact that there's an upper limit on how hot you can be, given what you see coming out in the X-rays. The calculation of the superfluid transition temperature could, you know, that's an important piece of the calculation that could maybe be done a bit better. And then the mode dynamics, there's an interesting problem in the ordinary fluid dynamics of the mode, which I don't have time to talk about, but also you want to do the hydrodynamics of the superfluid a little better than people have done. So anyway, it looks like it's still an interesting problem. And that's my spiel for today. Yeah, Ira?
So, can you talk a little bit about what's known in the external laboratory about hyperons? And also a related question is, when you apply that kind of stuff inside a nuclear medium, do you have to worry about the hyperons being...
Yeah, there are lots of effects in medium. Okay, so I'll answer the second one first. Yeah, in medium you get quasi-particles, basically. You really need to treat not just the hyperon, but all the junk that it's dragging around. And so you get this effective mass, which is less than the bare mass, and that's a pretty important factor. It's only like a factor of two, but when you multiply four factors of two together, it gets to be significant. There are other things in the...
So does that mean you get lower density?
Yeah, that's crucial to getting the density, to getting hyperons coming in at 5 × 10⁴ grams per cubic centimeter, rather than 10 × 10⁴, which is what you get with bare particles. The Fermi liquid theory. You're really treating these as quasi particles, and instead of putting in the masses, you really want to put in the whole chemical potential, which involves this effective mass and all this other isospin symmetry energy and all this other crap. Okay, so then the first question, how much do we know about these things in the lab? Well, making them on their own, that's been done since the 50s or something like that. These were one of the first non-nucleonic things that got made, and people can measure masses and decay beta decay rates and things like that. But what's really nice is when you make these things in nuclei. Some nuclei, you can make two of the neutrons turn into lambdas. So when you've got two lambdas together and you watch them decay, that's nice because, well, you can measure the decay rate. And now it's not the vacuum decay rate, it's the decay rate in a dense medium, the nucleus. So there's some non-zero Fermi momentum. And there's the two of them together. So in principle, you can measure some kind of interaction between the two, which supposedly gives you this superfluid band gap. Although the numbers on that, I think, are pretty lousy.
Is the in-nucleus decay that different other than just the suppression of the phase space? I mean, in the sense that, I mean, the vacuum decay and the medium decay, it's mostly just there's a lot of states that...
There's the phase space, and then, there's also factors in the Feynman diagrams that change. Like, there's this, you know, the weak interaction, the pure quark-quark interaction is vector minus axial vector. But then if you look at beta decay of, ordinary beta decay, neutron, proton, electron, then it's vector minus 1.26 axial vector. So that factor out in front, that's allowing for all the strong interaction gunk you're dragging along because this thing's buried in a baryon. And that number changes a bit in a dense medium. Actually, the sigma reaction rate is really sensitive to that, it turns out. It almost identically cancels out in a vacuum. And so we had to do a much more careful calculation to pick up stuff that people would usually neglect as beyond leading order. Let's see, what else? So it's basically the lambdas. Sigmas, in principle, when you smack these nuclei, you make sigmas, but the trouble is the sigmas decay really fast into lambdas, and you essentially can't see them. So the lambdas last long enough that you can measure some numbers, somewhat iffy though they are. So for getting the sigma superfluid band gaps, for example, you just say, well, okay, we can consider it, there are sort of QCD type calculations that say it has to be between the lambda band gap and about 10 times the lambda band gap. And so you just look at that range.
Okay, well, so Ben's here all day tomorrow, and he also wants to find him. And he and I will be appearing at Ask for Lunch. Yes?
Yeehaw!
Yeehaw! Okay.